We're on. Okay, so back after a quick break. And as Hillary mentioned, we wanted to spend some time talking about these bigger picture issues that, that have come up during the course of the interview. And I'm curious what prompted your interest in the history and philosophy of science and when that kind of started being something you were really interested in.
Right. It actually came about in a sort of trivial way almost, but I it crystallized with my reading of Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, and I know that's a kind of a hokey book in a lot of ways. Nevertheless, he's got some really interesting points that he makes in there about how science is done. And there were a couple of things that really caught my attention in that book. And one was his discussion of Poincaré's assertion that if there's one explanation for a given set of events, there is an infinite set of explanations for that same set of events. And that really got me thinking, because this gets right down to the whole idea of scientific theory. If there's one, theories are based on empirical observations and making sense of them. That's what we do. And I'd already run across a situation where with the pH electrode, the first interpretation of the results that people got empirically from the pH electrode was that of selective diffusion of protons through the glass. And it fits perfectly. And so that's what people believed. And so for several years, they tried to improve on pH electrodes by making glass that the protons would diffuse better through. And studying that process, and then finally somebody did it with a deuterium isotope and demonstrated that the response was perfectly fine for the deuterium, and there was no deuterium diffusing. And so that set people for another set of explanations, and another explanation for it is is selective adsorption, and that's the one that we mostly go along with today, though that still isn't perfect. pH ends up being defined as that which a pH meter reads. That's our IUPAC definition of pH these days. That's how much we understand. But that was an example. It turns out that the Nernst equation, which the pH meter follows, is just the relationship between chemical potential and electrical potential. And so any means there is of converting chemical potential difference to an electrical potential difference is going to give you an Ernstian response. There could be others. There are others. So another thing that came up in Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance was a discussion of manuals. It was motorcycle manuals. It got me thinking about writing and communicating, because he said you don't start out a motorcycle manual describing the threads on the head bolt. You start with what the motorcycle does, what's its function, and work down. And it introduced me to the whole concept of top-down learning and teaching as opposed to bottom-up, which chemistry is largely based on. The third thing that was in Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance was the concept of gumption traps and how you can sort of get your energy drained by getting stuck in places and how to move your way out of them. And I saw that was of immediate value in operating and managing a research group. You know, I could see several gumption traps at work right away in real time. I had my research group, they'd come over to the house. Once a week we went our way. I dragged them through chapter by chapter reading Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. We had wine and crackers and Zen. And so it was good. Rick Gilst was in the group at that time. It was a time of high activity for the group, but it got me thinking, not just about doing science, but how science is done.
you think it's something that other scientists are paying attention to, or maybe they should be paying attention to a bit more, these ideas of multiple theories and how science is done, and really thinking critically about their process?
I think it would be very helpful. And there was a time when philosophy and science were not separated. Science wasn't called science then, it was called natural philosophy. And people studying it were studying the arena of ideas and truthfulness and expression and things of that sort, along with trying to sort out natural phenomena. It became separate with the rise of empiricism and the development of the term science and scientific research. So scientific research became this combination of empirical investigation and theoretical interpretation, and became increasingly divorced from the natural philosophy over the years, until now the people who study how science is done and the people who do the science are quite different sets.
You mentioned a couple of times today and yesterday that scientists and the public would be better served if there was a increased understanding of the difference between facts and explanation and real and theoretical understandings of things. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about that.
Well, I came to be thinking about what it is we do know for sure. And even if you take Poincaré's assertion that there may be multiple explanations, now infinite, of course, is way too many. For us, it's finite, and it's finite because we have limited vocabulary and we have limited set of mathematical tools and so on. But if you imagine the universe, you know, and you imagine populations which grew up in a different context, using different languages, different mathematical approaches and so on, you'd find that they were probably interpreting the same observations that we make, but they'd end up with different equations. I mean, some of the things we, like entropy, is something we constructed, right? And potential energy, these are mental constructs that we have, even though they work exquisitely accurately in empirical equations that we've developed. I'm sorry, I lost track of the question. Oh, no.
I was just hoping that you could talk a little bit more. It was kind of a vague question, but just to talk a little bit more about, you know, the understanding of facts, explanations, and real and theoretical.
Oh, right. So back to Poincaré. If there are multiple explanations for a given set of observations, the thing that isn't changing when we think about that is the set of observations. Now, it may be that these are faulty, but it may be that they're accurate. And assuming that that we've made a set of accurate observations, or that they've been confirmed, or there's, in fact, I ran across a quote the other day that said, no experimental observation should be believed unless it's confirmed by theory, which is a nice inversion of the way I've been thinking about it all. But what it means is, when we're able to make an explanation of something, when we're able to develop a theory, what it means is that the facts that we used in coming to that explanation are consistent. That's really all that it means. But it does mean that. They're consistent. They're consistent with each other. They collectively make sense. And so if you can take a set of observations, empirical facts, and make sense of them, that sort of confirms that these observations are valid or real. And now, is that the only explanation? It would be very nice if people understood absolutely not. And we expect, it seems to me, a disconnect to argue that a particular theory is true, when at the same time, back here someplace, and in the back of the public's mind as well, we know that it's going to be revised or replaced. It will be. And so I believe that my theory of equilibrium partition and electrospray ionization is useful, Do I believe it's true? Do I believe that it's the fact of how things work? No, I don't. I mean, the electrospray drop does what it does. We make an analogy of it, we make a metaphor, a picture, best we can. Now, the fact that I've been able to get to derive some empirical equations that actually work, those things I think are valid. They work, and they're going to have to be taken into account in any future version of somebody's explanation. You see? And so, if we're constantly backed into a corner of defending theories that we know are going to change, instead of demonstrating how it is that we believe what we believe, then I think that we're arguing on the wrong side of the argument. I think that, and the irony of it all is that even though theories get all the attention, oh, so-and-so has developed a new theory, scientists say, you know, we hear this all the time, and it's all about explanations and theories. It's the only thing that's satisfying, really, in the wrong sense. But when you think about what it is you learned when you were taking science classes, very, very little of it was a theory. How many theories were parts of problem sets? Really? It isn't there. It's so we study and study and study all of these empirical relationships that we've developed. Now, the gravitational equation doesn't explain gravity. But it does explain the motion of planets and satellites and you name it throughout the universe. Well, not throughout the universe, throughout as far as we know. Philosophers in the past have not made a clean distinction between what we don't know about explanations and what we don't know about empirical observations. They put them more or less in the same category because one cannot assert that they are universally true, either of them. In terms of empirical observations, they are consistently true within the boundaries over which we've tested them and which we verified that they work. Ohm's law works just absolutely great with any conductor, with semiconductors, forget it. So we know where these boundaries are for the empirical laws that we use all the time. And part of the refinement of working with empiricism is to define increasingly or extend those boundaries. But within those boundaries, by gosh, it's true. It works. And it works consistently, and we count on it, or we couldn't cure disease or build bridges. And so this is the fundamental part of science that really works. It's the part that we spend 95% of our time teaching, and it is universally ignored. As in terms of this argument about what's true and what's not true, is science valid, is it not? And so that's the argument that I'm taking. I have I don't know if this is appropriate or not, within this context, but I have been thinking about the diagram of the scientific method, and it's a circle, right? And what comes out? In virtually every diagram of the scientific method, what comes out is a theory. And so the empirical facts that went into helping develop that theory are just lost up here someplace. They're not really illustrated as a product. I think scientific knowledge comes in two parts. I think it comes in the what and the why. And I think these are very different from each other. In terms of the what, we have our empirical relationships that work, that we use all the time, and they have boundaries. And these boundaries are what gets tested in that form of knowledge. In the explanation part of it, in the why part, we have these models and metaphors that we produce that help us to understand why this is the way it is. And they build pictures that are useful for us, and they're useful for predicting new tests of the theory and so on. But they are, the theory part of it itself is likely to be revised and may even be totally changed. That doesn't mean it wasn't useful. And theories can be, I think theories should be tested, should be measured on their degree of robustness, not on their degree of truthfulness, because that test they can pass. But robustness comes from, like Einstein's general theory of relativity. We make another test, and by gosh, you know, there is magnetic, or there is mass lensing and things like that. And so, so there is time dilation, and we've tested those things, we found them to exist, and so that makes that theory increasingly robust. Theories that have no way to be tested have no way to become more robust. And so trying to compare a theory that has no way to be tested and say that this theory deserves to be taught in science classrooms along with every other theory because all theories are equal, you see, isn't really a very good argument for a science class. I mean, however useful that theory might be in other contexts in terms of science, if it can't be tested, if its robustness can't be improved. So we were talking about beliefs. Mm-hmm. You know, if you don't believe in solar warming, global warming, then fine, you don't believe in it. But the thing is that the conjecture that it's occurring and that it's significantly and caused or enhanced by man's activity, that is an explanation of the empirical observation that the warming is happening, and it's testable. Its robustness can be improved, and does, and is. So I've made this diagram of the what I would now use as a diagram of the scientific method. It has two outputs. We're producing two different kinds of things. It has two lobes. We have the explanatory lobe over here. We have the empirical lobe over here. What comes out down here is what we call laws or rules. What comes out over here are the explanations of why. And the reason that scientists say that they don't ever follow the scientific method is that it's just too simplistic. This has the complications in it. You can wander around in this figure eight. You can work over here. You can work over here. In the case of and the fact that you have to start someplace and end up someplace else is, of course, all scientists know that's nuts. That isn't how it works. That isn't how we think. That isn't at all. What happens?
So you mentioned yesterday that there's a problem in the teaching of chemistry and in the structure of chemistry departments, in part because we haven't revised the chemistry curriculum in over 50 years. And I'm curious if you would like to see more than just the chemistry curriculum revised, but perhaps science education revised so that more of the general public understands the way that scientists actually think, as opposed to perhaps a scientific method that doesn't really portray how science works at all.
Right. There are several problems. one is we worry too much about cramming a certain number of facts into students in order to satisfy some curriculum requirements, in my opinion. And there was a study that showed up in a blog that I get out of Stanford a couple of years back that showed that in terms of retention, tested several years after graduation, there was no difference between BA and BS degree graduates in science, which is really astounding when you think about it, because the BS people have had some 20 more or more credit hours of extra intense stuff. Where did it go? And so I really came to the conclusion that towards the end of my teaching career, though I didn't really know exactly how to do it, but more and more I tried, that it was important to impart to students how it was that I, as an academic or as a practicing analytical chemist, thought about problems. What it was that that intrigued me, what my tool set was for going at a solution, and how I came to a solution, and then how I disseminated that solution out to the world, and what difference I thought that it might make. I thought that was as important as any underlying set of facts. The other, and I thought too, gee, just think, if a student went through college and they learned about, they learned that same thing from an historian, you know, and from a person teaching literature, and from an economics professor, and from an organic professor, that they, how rich they would be. What kind, imagine the set of tools that they would have to be able to bring to any kinds of problems that they foresaw in the future. Not just a set of equations that might work, but actual ways of thinking about something. That would be rich. Wouldn't that be rich indeed? And I just said, we don't do that. I'm thinking right now about an essay collaborating with a grade school chum that I've just reconnected with on the problem set. I was helping a student work through a problem they came in with in an office hour, and I was at the board, turned around to ask her a question about what she would be doing next on this, and she's busy flipping through the textbook, page after page, and I said, what are you doing? And she said, I'm looking for the example problem. And I said, how's that going to help you? And she said, well, it's going to show me how to set this up. I'm trying to get her to think through how to set it up. She's looking for the example problem that's going to show her how to set it up. So my friend Henry calls this learning by pattern recognition. And so when does life present us problems in the same pattern that they occur in a problem set? So in a way, I think that what we find that we end up doing is, what the students end up with is something I call vaporware. It really isn't likely to stick. So, and this problem set mentality, this method of teaching science, got set up from junior high on. And the students get into a pattern of how to pass a course by, in a sense, gaming the problem set. You do this for the problem set, then you can do it, then the same problems, the same patterns of problems are going to show up on the hour exams and the final on your trip. You've got it made, right? And now, 10 or 15% of the students in the class aren't going to do it that way. They're going to learn the problems. They're going to learn how to solve the problems by thinking them through. You could give them extraneous data in the problem, and it wouldn't throw them off. but for the most part, I think that a lot of our teaching is wasted, and I think that's very unfortunate.
Now, Now I wanted to switch gears a little bit and ask kind of a big question about, you know, you've been able to see the field of mass spectrometry evolve. You know, you said you kind of backed into it, but you backed into it during a time when lots of things were changing. And I was curious if you could reflect on that a little bit and also talk about maybe where you see mass spec going in the future.
Oh, it was so wonderful to get into mass spectrometry. Not only do I love the people, as mentioned before, it just feels like home going to a mass spec meeting. It is a really dynamic, a tremendously dynamic field. And I really feel as though ASMS, the American Society for Mass Spectrometry, has been key in this. They have gotten mass people who are interested in mass spectrometry together for decades now. And it doesn't matter where they're coming from, whether they're in environmental testing or whether they're in a pharmaceutical company or whether they're academics, whether they're interested in instrumentation or fundamentals or whatever, we all go. And learn. And so, and then the setting up of the journal and so on, their main goal has been to share information. That's been the primary thing. They keep it inexpensive. We all get copies of the journal. It's something you can do out of pocket without even thinking about it, which is almost unique in organizations these days. Selfless group, by and large, of people willing to share their ideas. And I think that's what causes things to happen so quickly. As I mentioned, what happened with the triple quadrupole, for example. I mean, it was just like that, but it was around ASMS that acceleration occurred. The same thing occurred with MALDI, and the same thing occurred with ElectroSpray. And every time some new breakthrough happens, the users are there, the manufacturers are there, the academics are there, the researchers are there, everybody, and they can all take their part in it right away. And the field has continued to grow, the society has continued to grow, and I can't predict a plateau in this right now because of there's still so much more to go. When the first triple quadrupole, we lost 99% of the ions going between each quadrupole. What was left almost, you might think, my gosh. But we got such a huge improvement in selectivity that the loss in sensitivity hardly mattered. And now, I was hearing from one of my colleagues at Science and SciEx the other day, I think that with ElectroSpray ionization and the triple quadrupole set up in unselected mode, mass selected mode, that they're looking at something like 10%. They are getting detectable ions for several percent of the molecules that are going in from the sample. When you think about Avogadro's number, that's incredible. It is really marvelous. And I think we're still moving. It's still moving. The work that I've been doing on the theory of complex mixtures, think about it. We talk about comprehensive analysis. That's a word that's just come into the vocabulary in the last decade or so. Comprehensive analysis. Nobody thought that was possible before. Comprehensive analysis. Every metabolite. That was unthinkable, and it's brought about as a result of the combination of chromatography and mass spectrometry, incredible improvements in resolution in the mass spec, particularly the implementation of MSMS and MSMSMS and so on in the solution of these problems, data interpretation techniques that are used to sort out the metabolites from the things that aren't, and it is that are used to identify the proteins based on their peptides. It's incredible. And I don't see the end of it. I think it's just the beginning. And mass spectrometry is now having an absolutely major impact on virtually every area of research, chemical and biomedical. Yeah, I'm a fan.
Do you have any other questions?
I don't.
Well, I think that's all for our questions. So obviously at the end, we always make sure there's nothing more you'd like to talk about or anything we missed that you want to make sure gets in.
No, I'm fine. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank
you.
A very nice experience.